Let's call this meeting of the House Health and Social Service Committee to order. It is 3:04 PM, March 12th. Present is Representative Keller, Representative Seaton, Representative Reinbold, Representative Nygaard, Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Higgins, and I appreciate everybody being here. So let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. Let's see here. Let's recognize our staff today, and we have Representative Pruitt just joining us. We have Butch Carver as our House Recording Secretary, and then Betsy Dorn as our LIO moderator. Paul Verhagen is my committee man, so if anybody needs anything, raise your hand. He'll come see you, and we'll see if we can't help you. A little housekeeping, if you have a cell phone or an iPad or anything that's going to disturb us, and we are disturbed, you owe us donuts. So if this thing is, to turn them off. That's the best thing. So let's do that. And with that today, we have one bill today, House Bill 16, the Adult Public Assistance Eligibility, sponsored by Representative Keller and Representative Wilson, Peggy Wilson. All right, at this time, I'll entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute for HB 16 version C as a working document.
I move and adopt committee substitute HB 16-28-LS0059/C as a working document.
Hearing no objections, the CS before us is before us for the purpose of discussion. Representative Keller, if you would please indicate your name and you're at the mic, we can begin.
Thank you. My name is Representative Wes Keller. I'm a District 7 representative, and I'm sponsor of HB 16. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing and probably working on this bill. So thank you. I don't expect it, actually, I don't anticipate it to move out without close scrutiny. I think it's an important bill. The CS for HB 16, version C, gives Health and Social Services a tool that I don't believe they have right now, and I think they can use. It confronts directly a problem that we face when trying to provide people with public assistance, and that problem is alcohol abuse and illegal drug abuse. Addiction to drugs and alcohol make the mission of Division of Public Assistance almost impossible, because part of that mission is to promote self-sufficiency. And just intuitively, I think we all know that self-sufficiency and addiction are at least in tension. I mean, there's a problem we have to deal with there. The tool is to make is simply to make an upfront determination when somebody applies for public assistance of whether or not there's a problem with abuse of alcohol or use of illegally obtained drugs. That's the only thing. Very simply, all it is when they do the application in all areas of public assistance, that they would have to sign a statement saying, I'm not abusing alcohol, I'm not using illegally obtained drugs for the time that they're receiving the assistance. HB 16 does not get into prescribing what the department should do about it when they become suspicious or make a determination that there is an addiction problem. It doesn't describe it, partly because there's services and means available to address it, and it allows them the discretion to deal with it when they confront it. This thing is rocket science, and in that sense, I am deeply appreciative that the committee is doing this. And what I mean by that is this is the sections of law and public assistance. It's very lengthy, and to go through and to determine the ramifications of change like this, it's difficult. It's difficult to understand for the department, I think, and it's difficult for us as legislators. And what it's hopefully will do is take this addiction issue and maybe take some of the difficulty away for those that are on the front line, the social workers out there. There's three areas of public assistance that we generally talk about. One is general assistance. One of the sections of law you'll see as we go through the bill, and that's for the needy folks. long-term, and then there's adult assistance, and then there's temporary assistance. And I think I'm going to let the department and division to give you a better distinction. The reason I point out the fact that they're there is partly to let you know that there's going to be some question raised about why we would ask a question about drug abuse and or addiction to an elderly, disabled, or blind, or a person that they, we're trying to help. And I just want to point out that in that particular section about adult assistance, I want to just read the, one of the laws about the purpose. The purpose of this section was, and this is 4725-290. It's not in your bill. I have a copy of it if you want me to pass it out. But I think it's the point is real simple. The purpose is to furnish financial assistance as far as practicable to the needy, age, blind, and disabled persons, and to help them attain self-support and self-care. So even in that area, there is a concern that we need to have with the addiction problem. There may be some tweaks needed in the bill. I think it may have ramifications, for example, on burial in, of a needy person, and that may have to be tweaked. I don't know. We'll see as we go through it. Because of the complexity of the role of public assistance, and because I think that we all want to do the right thing, I trust that we can all work together and make this a really good bill. I would like, with your permission, Mr. Chair, to let my staff go through the bill section by section.
That would be great.
Yep.
Thank you, Representative Keller. For the record, my name is Jim Pound, staff to Representative Keller. I did provide you with a sectional, a brief sectional, you know, yesterday, and I apologize. We had a miscommunication between staff and myself on getting it out to you yesterday. Essentially, Section 1 of the bill takes care of, is, was in the previous version. It has to do with verifying that an individual is illegally in the state of Alaska, legally in the United States, before they can apply for assistance. Section 2 requires that an application for general relief must sign a sworn statement that will he or she is in the state legally. That's one part of it. And second of all, they will not abuse alcohol, or they will not abuse or use illegally obtained drugs. And use the term illegally obtained drugs because there are some medical situations where, I'm not sure how it's done, I'm sure the chair has a better idea of clinical marijuana, I suppose. And I've, at some point in time, I would suspect that down the road we will probably have legal marijuana for medical purposes in the state of Alaska, and I didn't want that to be one of those variables. They say, well, you're using marijuana. Well, no, I'm not. I'm using it legal to have a way of being able to not be restricted from that. Established 3 is the applicant recipient may be subject to an investigation. This is already part of the process. There's already, when an individual applies, there's already a process where they investigate and look at the individual. It includes them to be able to deal with the suspicion of where they have a suspicion that the individual is using or abusing alcohol and or illegal narcotics or drugs. The information for a refusal to submit based on testing can be used at an administrative hearing if there's an appeal. If they decide to if the department decides to withdraw funding, the individual has the right to appeal administratively. And if they refuse to take a test, that information can be used as part of the administrative appeal process. Requires an applicant in Section 5, I'm sorry, to assistant must, again, it's just, primarily there's a lot of repetitive here. Section 5 deals with individuals who are in adult assistance, which is a different aspect of assistance for those seeking. They are primarily they are primarily the ones that are the blind, the elder, the senior citizens, stuff like that. You know, we think about drug abuse, and we think a lot of it, a lot of it has to do with young people. But, you know, it really doesn't anymore. I mean, most of us that came out of the 60s were exposed to it in some shape, form, or description, and we're the ones that are in that age group now, unfortunately. So it's something that we have to look at from more of a perspective of those are the people that may still be using illegal drugs or abusing alcohol because of their life. Again, it's, we repeat ourselves with the information of refusal being used in an administrative hearing in Section 7. Section 8 goes into the other section, which is temporary assistance. And that is, again, that they must sign a statement when they're applying that they are not using illegal drugs or abusing alcohol. Section 10 is the process for which the department can contact the individual if they suspect that there's a reasonable suspicion that there's a problem, and how they go about doing that. Again, we deal with protective payee. What it is, essentially what we're doing here is just false information. I mean, if you apply for the assistance and you provide false information, that the state does have the right to restrict under existing statute, 40% initially. If they don't get help, then it can be increased, and ultimately it can, I believe it's after 12 months, can be removed completely if they don't try to help themselves. And that's the whole principle of this bill, is to give the department more of a tool that an individual has to say up front, I don't and I will not while I'm on assistance. And that has to be that has to be a standard they need to live up to. And that's essentially what the bill does as far as the sectional. Much larger than the original bill, and I apologize for that, but we think that this is a much better direction to go. And because the bill definitely does not have a problem, as we understand it from our legal, with a constitutional issue.
If I could add one thing, Mr. Chair, and I think it just in the words it didn't come out, but in Section 10 is where, if there is a suspected case, that's where the applicant can be submitted to a drug testing or alcohol or illegal drug use testing. It's on page 5, about line 6, 7, in that area.
Reading through the bill, and I might have got the answer already, but I want to make sure I'm clear on it. In your page 1, line 1, an act relating to the procedures and eligibility for specific cash assistance. Now, from my understanding, we're talking about all assistance, not just cash assistance with this bill, correct? Or does this just strictly mean cash assistance?
Mm-hmm. Sure, it's all assistance, actually. Cash assistance happens to be one of the aspects of it. And whether you want to use the term cash and or check and or direct deposit or however the department actually provides these benefits. I mean, technically, we're not dealing with things like food stamps and stuff like that. We're dealing with the actual dollars and cents that are handed to an individual to take care of their lives.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. I guess one of the questions that I'm trying to figure out is the limitations on the bill, and we have other cash assistance programs. We have the senior benefits payment program, which is not covered under this bill, and why would it be that you are covering blind or other people but not the senior cash payment program?
If I could, the adult assistance does include the age, but it's under the category of public assistance, when there's an application made for help for needy folks in this category. Your senior benefits, I haven't reviewed the law recently, but I it's a separate section of law, and we were dealing with the cash public assistance part.
Go ahead, follow up.
Yeah, 4745301 is a senior benefit cash program. That's an eligible individual may receive monthly cash assistance payments, $250 if the individual household does not exceed 75% of the federal poverty, 175 if it's 100%, but above 75, and 125 if it does not exceed 175%. And I'm trying to figure out if we are targeting certain cash assistance programs and not others? I mean, I guess I just want to make sure that we're treating everyone fairly. I mean, I guess, you know, the other cash assistance program we have is a PFD, which is cash assistance. It's not based on need, but it's definitely cash coming from the state to individuals in the state, and I don't see that program under here. Is that because, or why is that?
Representative Seaton, through the chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah. The longevity bonus and the PFD, I don't have a clear answer to give you as far as the distinction of why we just picked the public assistance section of law and not those. I think probably in my mind it has to do with the fact that we are trying to build self-sufficiency, put people back on their feet, give them assistance, get them, you know, help them, assist them in their quest to become productive citizens. And I, when you start talking about PFD, that's a lot different premise. That's a premise that we are sharing the resources benefit that we have in the state, you know, across the state, and the longevity bonus, I think, is a little different too. That's partly because of the fact of seniors we try to honor and give them assistance, especially if they're in need. But you won't find, I don't think, in the mission that the intent is to, in those areas, the intent is to put somebody back on their feet. But again, that's a real quick answer to something I hadn't thought through.
Representative Reibold?
I just want to make sure that I understand. First of all, thank you for bringing this bill. I think it's an honorable attempt to try to get people and, you know, catch, you know, certain circumstances that maybe we need to be aware of. You know, it's bringing awareness to an issue that we need to address as a state. I want to make sure, so that basically they're not going to be able to get the cash assistance, but the other assistance they will, like the medical assistance, they will still be able to get. Is that correct?
As far as I'm saying, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. So the state still will be funding, you know, the consequences of drug abuse potentially.
I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I would appreciate if you would ask that question of the department when they come up. Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Nagak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm having a hard time trying to figure out how to say these things in a good way, and not to offend anybody, but I just don't know how I'm going to do that. Because if I say something, I'm going to offend people here, and I'm going to offend my people. Who I'm representing. Unfortunately, we have a problem in Alaska, especially in rural Alaska. There's few jobs and few opportunities to get cash in a lot of the villages. You want a job, you have to go out and look for work, or you have to travel to some of the, like Prudhoe Bay and Red Dog and other places in the state. And also, a lot of people in rural Alaska especially, multiple families live in one house. And so, and they get cash assistance. Usually it's the adults or the seniors who receive the cash assistance. So and some of the people who benefit from that are the children or the grandchildren in a lot of cases. So the cash assistance wasn't allowed because of drug testing or because of alcohol abuse. That would impact not only the people who you're trying to keep away from getting assistance, but it would impact the elders, and it would impact the children especially. They would be punished because of something that they had no way of having something to do with trying to stop that from happening in their families. And so I have And it says, you know, a lot of the assistance programs target natives, Alaska natives in rural Alaska. And so I'm just having a hard time trying to come up with something that positive on this, but it's going to impact everybody. And marijuana, of course, we all make choices, and alcohol and marijuana choices. And I made a choice a long time ago, to stop both marijuana and alcohol. And I'm not going to be a person who says I didn't do all this stuff, because I did. I'm not sorry about it. It happens. I mean, you know, when you're part of living in Alaska, you do a lot of things. And so I don't do them today, and I'm better for it. But it's it's still out there. I mean, I think 1 ounce is legal or quasi-legal or whatever you call it in the state. You know, you just can't smoke in front of people, but it does happen. And so, and alcohol is is a disease. Dependence on alcohol is a disease. And unfortunately, it's, this bill won't stop the disease of alcohol. It is just going to punish those people who are trying to, through no fault of their own, need assistance from one point or another. After I was being mayor of Wild Things, I couldn't find a job for a long time. Nobody would hire me. And I didn't have, and I tried to get unemployment insurance. All those years I put into that unemployment insurance, they wouldn't give it to me because I made too much money, they said in those days. So I couldn't get the benefits of unemployment insurance if I wanted to. And that happens in a lot of cases in rural Alaska when those high-paying jobs, you can't get unemployment insurance. So it's hard to get all that other stuff. So I'm just worried about how it's going to impact those people in rural Alaska who depend on assistance from one time or another. And I don't know how this is going to help people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the Chair, Representative Nogiak, I really appreciate and I think I really understand, maybe probably not to the extent you do. I would like to let my staff, we did address the part about the children, and then I want to make a couple responses on a couple things that already exist that this bill doesn't, but just let you know they're there.
Again, through the Chair, for record, Jim Pound, Representative Nogiak, through the Chair. If you look on page 5, line 11, section 11, there's a reference where it says deny or terminate benefits or assign a protective payee to manage the cash assistance. So we're not specifically punishing children. In other words, if an individual has children and they're abusing drugs and or alcohol, first of all, the department is to help that individual get off of it. But the funding can go to another member of the family who's to take care of, to make sure that the children are still taken care of. We're not trying to punish the children for the sins of the adults, so to speak, for lack of a better term.
Go ahead, follow up.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. you're trying to punish a person who's drinking alcohol and abusing drugs, but you're going to continue the cash payment into another family member. And then I don't know if you know the dynamics of how it is in Bush, Alaska, especially where there's no cash, hardly any cash. They have to bring in cash when permanent fund dividends come, a store will, to in order to take care of all that cash that's needed in the village because they don't have it. They only have it during the dividend times. You know, they put in a whole lot of money or in a lot of the villages, if you have cash a check, that check goes throughout the community until it's worn out because there's no cash. And so it's hard to, you know, it's hard to live in rural Alaska under those difficult situations. And so I'm just kind of concerned that it will impact people who don't want the impact in this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if I could follow up, I just I really appreciate your concern, and I hope we can come up with ways to address that carefully and thoughtfully. I just wanted to point out that you made a comment that the bill doesn't fix the alcoholism problem, and boy, I just couldn't agree. I mean, with you more, and I wish it could. You know, it's but there are programs out there. You know, and what this bill is intent here is to help give tools to the department and to the division so that when they know and can document and find out when there is an alcoholism problem or a drug abuse problem, that the other areas services can be made available to the people in the extent that we have them. And as you know, it seems it's really depressing because not many of them work all the way anyway. I mean, it's a real struggle ongoing. The other thing I wanted to mention is that this is kind of related, but not directly. On the adult assistance part, I just want to point out that the law very explicitly says that if a person receiving assistance is incapable of self-care or of the care of the funds, then the department can pick somebody to give the money to. That's in the adult assistance portion of public assistance. And I would think that, although I don't know that it's applied that way now, that the incapability of handling funds, again, is tied, I think, to alcohol and drug abuse. So there is a vehicle there. But again, I share your concerns. Let's look for ways to ease the any problems it may cause. We don't want to cause harm.
Representative Reinbold?
Okay. You know, I'm going to take a little different twist on this. I'm not sure that, you know, it's the state, a government's responsibility to be giving out cash, period. I mean, fundamentally. All of this bill seems to be doing in my mind to simplify things is it's identifying Alaskans or U.S. citizens. You know, it's simply, you know, identifying people who are abusing drugs and alcohol. Is it a wise thing to be giving cash to people who are abusing alcohol and drugs? Is that wise? We need to ask ourselves as a state, is that the maximum return on our investment for our public resource dollars? You know, maybe, you know, that money should be invested into treatment programs for these people and mental health things. So I guess I just think that this bill possibly has some real benefits to identifying where problems are and addressing them. And I think this could be a good thing for the state.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the spirit and the heart behind what you're saying is exactly why I'm sitting here carrying the bill. You know, I really wish, I hope that we can find ways to solve the problem. Thanks.
Let's go with Representative Tarr first. Okay. I think she was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the effort, you know, and the intention of this legislation, but wondered if you could comment on the constitutionality, because we followed up with that based on research on what's happened in other states. And so far, no other state law has been found to be constitutional, and some states are waiting on implementing regs because they're waiting on court decisions. But what we were told by Ledge Legal is even the CS is probably still unconstitutional. So I'm just wondering how we maybe got mixed information, and I think it was related to the suspicionless testing portion of it. So maybe you have more information you could share on that. And then also, just I haven't been able to find any evidence with the bill materials that individuals who are receiving public assistance are actually the individuals who are abusing drugs or alcohol. And in Florida, when they had testing done, 2.6% of the individuals tested positive, which is actually well below the average for the general population, which is 10 to 12%. So just trying to figure out the cost-benefit analysis of this in terms of how much it would cost to administer a program, maybe to, certainly want to identify who those bad individuals are and hopefully have services available. But are we actually going to be spending more on the program than we would save by, you know, limiting the individuals who receive those dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr. First of all, we don't spend any money on programs with the bill. There's nothing there. Secondly, on the Florida information, I was also stunned at the fact that they found out that those on public assistance had such a low percentage that tested positive. But frankly, being maybe cynical in this day and age with all the information and studies we have, I just don't believe that substance abuse does. You know, I mean, I substance abuse is a problem. I mean, I am convinced it is. You know, and I'm convinced that it's a real problem in the context of self-sufficiency, self-identity, self-worth, and I don't know why those numbers came out. I suspect there's a problem in how they're collecting data or something, you know, and I think we'll find out. But that just, I don't think that we're far enough down the road in Florida. That just happened a short time ago. Lastly, on the Constitution, I'm going to let my staff speak to that, but that's news to me. That's why we came up with a CS, is to address the constitutional issues. Yeah.
To the chair, Representative Tarr. Again, Jim Pound, for the record. We don't have suspicionless in here. Everything is reasonable suspicion. Mm-hmm. So we're not random testing here. We are not. I mean, there has to be a reasonable suspicion that an individual is, I mean, a person walks into, every 6 months, I believe they come in to meet at least minimum. And the worker sees this person either drunk or on drugs consistently. There's obviously a suspicion there. And that's where it kicks in. That's why when I discussed this with our counsel over in Alleged Legal, we discussed this. And I'm surprised that you got it. I don't know who you spoke with in counsel, and it's immaterial, but I was advised that this does meet muster.
Okay.
Representative Nagyak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, how can you establish reasonable suspicion, when... you're going to be going to the villages, because if you're going to be denying any benefits or cash assistance to people, you know, they're not going to be in Fairbanks or Anchorage or other places. Some of them may be, but most of them are going to be in rural Alaska, where it's going to be cost, where the cost benefits are a few. I mean, you know, it costs money to get to the villages. I mean, if I want to travel in the villages in my part of the world, I pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars from one way to a village. So if you're going to be denying services or cash assistance, how are you going to use this reasonable suspicion without going there, or how are you going to get to the villages to establish reasonable suspicion of drug and alcohol abuse? Mr. Chairman, thank you.
To the chair, Representative Nagyak. I want to answer by just looking at it from a little different perspective. If I need public assistance and I go into the division and I say I need help, and then what this bill proposes is that they give me a piece of paper that's an application for assistance. And in that application, I have to write down that I am not abusing alcohol or taking illegally obtained drugs, and that I'm a citizen, resident of the state of Alaska, I should say. Now, as a person filling that out, let's say for a minute that I do have an addiction problem, then I have a choice to make. One is to misrepresent on the paper, which will produce in the end, followed out different options, but, a problem for the division and the person on figuring out what to do. This does not impose a fine. It gives the power to the division to do something about it, including taking money away. The other thing is a person could say, no, I have an addiction problem, I will not sign that. You know, at that point, if a person refused to sign based on the integrity and knowing where he's at, he or she is at, then again, the division is faced with a challenge. Okay, what do I do here? This person is has a presuming to implying here that they have a problem. Okay, so then you look through your other parts of your tool chest. Okay, I have this drug substance abuse program that maybe I can make available. It's already there and paid for by the state. Or the same thing with alcohol abuse. So, but I don't think it's any different. I mean, as far as the making the determination in the rural or the urban, it's all based on the application and a self-provided statement of whether or not there is a problem. And I want to just throw this in. When the division comes up, they may want to address it, but the director of public assistance made me aware of some surveys that do the same sort of thing, and they're validated and normed, and I guess they're having some success with it in other jurisdictions, where they basically the person fills out, answers questions, and I got a copy from them and looked it over, and I can see where in answering the questions that were provided in this survey, they could come up with some kind of idea. Well, okay, there may be a problem here that we have to address. Maybe that's another option that the the division would suggest that the committee consider for inclusion. I don't know, but I'm just saying that option is out there. So it's not that this is inventing something brand new. It's a same concept.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. First of all, we're having people swear that they won't abuse alcohol, but I don't see a definition of abuse of alcohol in here. I mean, I presume that if there's a pregnant person in the family and they have any alcohol, is that abuse of alcohol? Is alcohol above having a level above 0.08, which would be legally not allowed to drive? Is that, what is the definition that somebody has to swear to, and that is alcohol abuse under the terms of the law?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, again, that's why I threw the survey concept in there, because it's will be based on the definition of the person signing the document.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think there's lots of people out there that use a lot of alcohol that wouldn't say that for them that's abusing alcohol. But it seems like if you're having someone swear to something in a legally binding document, which I'm presuming this is a legally binding document, and we have no standard of what that means other than what the person who's signing the document says it means, I think we've got a problem, because I don't think it's enforceable. But I guess going on from there, on page 4, number 6, we're adding to the temporary assistance program, where somebody is required to, number 6, a sworn statement that members of the family do not and will not, while receiving assistance, abuse alcohol or use legally obtained drugs or illegally obtained drugs. I'm not sure how we can have the person who is applying for temporary assistance do a sworn statement that nobody in the family is going to abuse alcohol or illegally or use illegally obtained drugs, or do we think that the person applying has the ability to make that sworn statement for everybody in the family?
I don't have a clear answer to that. Staff, worked on this. Or you have something to add to enlighten us, sir?
I have to look this over, but temporary. Okay, I see what you're referring to, number 6. Temporary assistance primarily deals with children, and I suspect that was put in there because if we're dealing in a household situation, we really would like to keep the children away from drugs and alcohol. And with temporary assistance is normally a single mother, single father, or whatever dealing with children, or a family that's dealing with children. And that the intent there really is to keep the drugs and alcohol away from the children.
Good. Follow up.
Just following up, and you know, I'm just raising the question, and I'm not meaning to be confrontational, but I guess the problem is that you're asking the member, whether it's single mother, single father, or it's a family that's just got problems, that they are swearing in a sworn statement that none of the kids are going to do some of the things that kids do. I'm troubled by whether that statement can be fully made in a sworn statement, and I guess I'm somewhat troubled in that on page 5 where it's saying provides false information or misrepresents, knowing that it was false to the department to obtain benefits, it seems like that's going to be almost the definition of fraud. And so I want to find out whether if the department decides that somebody else should receive the cash assistance instead of the person that's making the application, does that have the consequences of putting somebody in criminal liability because they requested the assistance and somebody in the family or themselves abuses alcohol at some point in time? So that's just something I think that we need to, as we work through this bill, find out whether there's more consequences to the sworn statement affidavit.
Through the chair, Representative, there's nothing criminally intent here. There's no criminal intent here.
And Representative Seaton, through the chair, Representative Keller here, I do appreciate the questions. You know, I don't feel threatened, and I appreciate the fact they're out there. And we'll get answers to these as we go. And next time, perhaps, Mr. Chair, we can have the legal services drafter online, and they may be able to help us with that. We'll, of course, get with them, too, and try to get that answered. So,
Representative Reimbold?
Okay, thank you. And I would agree that, you know, defining abuse, I think, is a great idea. It does give me great pause. I'm going to resort back to something that another member of this committee said, that it's unconstitutional to, you know, that this would be unconstitutional. I have a real problem with that. I want someone to show me where in our state or U.S. Constitution that says we must give cash assistance to those abusing drugs and alcohol. I mean, that just gives me great pause. People keep saying everything's unconstitutional. It seems like a fair tactic to me, you know, and it's something that, are we going to interpret it at whim, our Constitution, or are we going to read it for its meant? I mean, honestly, I don't believe our Constitution says that we have to do this. And what I believe our Constitution says is that our resources are to the maximum benefit of our people. And I would say a large percent of Alaskans would disagree that money given to people who are abusing drugs and alcohol is the maximum benefit to our people. I think rather, you know, investing, identifying the problem, setting up treatment programs, education, prevention would be a wiser, you know, way to use our money. Right now, our HESS budget is unsustainable. It's between 1.6 and 1.7 billion, if I have my figures accurate here. We can validate that with we have approximately 190,000 Alaskans that are on some sort of public assistance. We've got an issue. We need to educate. We need to get jobs. We need to get our economy going. And we need to get, the intent of this law is to get people independent. And I think it the intent is good.
You know, it's a pretty emotional bill, obviously. I don't want to get into debate about the Constitution here, I think we can get legal in here when it's time to have this discussion again, and we can talk about that. You know, our purpose today is to hear discussion on this bill, and you know, we'll work it forward with that. So, with that, Representative Nagyak.
I lost my train of thought. But there's no jobs in rural Alaska. I mean, geez, if there were jobs, I would really think differently about this. But You know, that is what we need to concentrate on, is to get people those jobs in the villages. How do we do that? You know, we have to open up, you know, ways to get to our resources, and that way, you know, we can have more jobs for people in the villages. And people used to depend on commercial fishing in a large part of the state. But that isn't viable anymore either. You know, there's so much restrictions because of the lack of fish and in some cases game that people depend on. There's so many things out there that are happening that a lot of people can't cope with especially in rural Alaska. I mean, I was just talking to people this afternoon about the possibility of development in rural parts of Alaska, a lot of places right now that have potential. And those jobs, those resources are tapped into, and there's a way to get them in and out, which we're trying to do in other committees, you know, we'll have jobs, hopefully. Hopefully we won't import the jobs, import people to take those jobs like it has been done in the past. I mean, you know, a lot of people, when jobs come, they come from out of the state to take those jobs. And in a lot of cases, people in rural Alaska don't have, don't have the means to go and go apply for a job even. And so I think we should concentrate on getting access to those resources and so people can get jobs. And how many people are we talking about that are abusing the system, that are abusing it or taking cash? I mean, I'm a product of assistance, public assistance, for my mom and dad. My dad worked, and then when they got, they were much older. My dad must have been over 50 when I was born. And so, I mean, you know, they were eight, and by the time we grew up, I mean, both my parents were old, and they were getting assistance, because that's what it was in those days. They had public assistance for elders and all that. I'm a product of that, me and my family. And most of us in our family are successful because of that. If it wasn't for public assistance, I wouldn't be standing in front of you. I mean, that's the reality in a lot of cases in rural Alaska. That's how people, in jobs in Barrow, where I live. Good thing we had the schools and all that stuff, Naval Arctic Research Lab. A lot of us, when we were able to, we were started working at the lab and making money. But in a lot of other villages, they don't have that, and that's what I'm concerned about. That. We're going to be. It's there already. The assistance is there. But once it's over, I mean, you know, it's over. We can't. You're putting more people into in serious conditions of trying to survive when there's nothing to survive in the first place, unless you get assistance. Thank you.
Thank you. If I could, just real quick, one is, I really appreciate what you're saying, Representative Nogiak, but the bill does not, is making a statement on public assistance. It's only public assistance when there's a case of substance abuse and trying to deal with the substance abuse element, in helping people be self-sufficient. So. I know you know that, but I just wanted to put on the record that the bill is not out to eliminate public assistance or to reduce it. It's to deal with the problem of the substance abuse in the context of our responsibility as public officials to put the money out there in a way that's appropriate. And we've decided as a group that we want the money to be spent in a way that meets their needs, meets people's needs that are needy, but it also and helps them become stand up on their own and be self-sufficient if possible. So the jobs are the answer. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, and I don't think this bill takes away from that.
I would agree. Jobs are important. Representative Tarr, did you?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate those comments. And just quickly with permission, it was alleged research report that I was referring to that talked about First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment issues. So I'll share that with members so they can have that to inform their thoughts on this. And appreciate your saying maybe Ledge Legal would be back if we have a bill up for questions, because that would be helpful. But I wanted to go back to the issue of cost a little bit. And I know there's not a fiscal note, but just in me trying to determine the cost-benefit analysis, in looking at the other states that tried to implement programs, nothing was the fiscal note, you know, none of them were under $1 million or more. And so just wondering, are we going to get a fiscal note from the department, or how can we sort of have some more information to assess, you know, what it would cost for administering a program like this? And again, if we're thinking about efficient use of our resources. Sure. Thank you.
Go ahead, follow up.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tarr. I realized when I said there is no cost here that I was speaking in the context. You know, I was thinking of the context being programs as opposed to programs to treat the substance abuse. I'm not going to divine or try to divine what the department will say the cost related to this is. I don't know. But do you have
to the chair, Representative Tarr, I'll be actually honest with you, we got this back. We had the 4-day break.
Okay.
We got this back yesterday. I got it over to the department yesterday. They haven't had time to do a fiscal note on it. So, yeah. So I'm sure there's one coming. But as Representative Keller indicated, we're not moving this bill out of here today anyway. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple questions. I guess the first one on the paying. Is it the intention in the bill that, you know, trying to figure out who's paying for the testing? Is that coming out being charged to the individual that's receiving the assistance? Is that coming out of the general bill, or is that going to be intended to be added on? And maybe that's going to be the fiscal note, but I didn't know what the intention is as to who pays for drug and alcohol testing when that suspicion is there and they want to require that testing.
The chair was going to see, and that'll be up to the department and the regulatory process.
Okay. And second question was on page one, on line 8, it says a person must be a citizen of the United States or legal alien as described in, you know, USC 1181 through 86, and not otherwise precluded from eligibility under state or federal law to be eligible for assistance. Can you tell me what those parameters are of not otherwise precluded from eligibility under state or federal law? And what that, you know, all those, is that one category, or are there a bunch of categories under state law, a bunch of categories under federal law? I'm just not aware of the full scope of not precluded from eligibility.
Again, to try to have to yield to the department on that, because they would know what the eligibility requirements are or aren't under state law. I mean, I think there's certain things having to do with you know, previous fraud or previous problems where, you know, some places where if you fraudulently received funds and were caught in a criminal contest, probably that you'd not be eligible to reapply for. But I would, again, yield back to the department when they come up to speak after us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So if there's no further questions, then maybe we should have the department come forward. Would that be okay? Is that the plan?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks, Wes.
Thank you.
All Put yourself on record with your name and your affiliation and what you do.
Good afternoon. My name is Ron Prayer. I'm the director of the Division of Public Assistance. Okay. Where would you like me to start?
Mr. Chair. I was a smart remark, and it wasn't. Oh, please don't. it would have been attempted humor. It would have been kind of weak.
Through the chair, I hope I have some wise remarks myself, but no guarantees. I could just take a brief moment, just kind of roll through this piece of legislation. I think that there are some potential. There's potential here, but there's also some potential implements or impediments to actually making this thing work. As was stated earlier, this first section, section one, section two, everything that deals with the General Relief Assistance Program. One of the I think the important things to note here is that most recipients of General Relief Assistance, so this is for our most indigent Alaskans. You have to have virtually no income, hardly any assets at all, and back in the day I could rattle those figures off for you, but I can't. I think it's pretty low numbers. But one of the critical things with this also is that there's virtually no cash transfer to a recipient. The three primary uses for the program are for burials, and those are typically, again, for the lowest income people in our programs and recipients of adult public assistance. The second largest outlay is for rent, and those payments are made as in the form of vendor payments directly to a landlord. So while we have about 40% of the people that are served through burial services, about 90% of the budget for the General Relief Assistance Program goes to burials. And that's often paid out through third parties. Sometimes the applicant is actually the funeral home, maybe a distant family member or a friend. So in those instances, the applicant that would be investigated or have to go through scrutiny of this may have no direct connection to the recipient of the benefit. Primary thing here, though, is that the benefit is largely goes out to a third party.
Thank you, Ron. Are you saying that in the area of adult assistance, 90% of the cash transfers are for burial? Did I hear you say that?
Through the chair, Representative Keller. No, that's for the General Relief Assistance Program. That's the
general. Okay.
General Relief Assistance, adult public assistance, different program, different benefit delivery.
I don't mean to, I'm just making sure I understand. So in the general relief area, and I realize that now, you're saying that the actual cash transfer that happened, 90% of it is for burial.
Right.
And obviously that wouldn't apply, to the bill. So yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that's correct. For Thank burials, you. And then for the other major chunk of the benefit that goes out is for rental assistance, and that typically goes to a vendor as well. I can't think of any instances where we would be given. So a maximum payment depends on your household size, but if you're a single adult that was being evicted, we could authorize $120 for that individual, and see, it's rare for that not to go directly to a landlord. So typically, and even individuals that we also provide supports for, we've bought, when I was an eligibility technician, I bought a bottle of propane and a tent for a homeless individual. That payment went to Western Auto, where the person went and used that voucher to purchase his goods. I think I'm going to take a breather right now.
You want to do a brief at ease?
No, I'm good.
Oh.
I'm good. Okay. I do. I do really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this today. I think that there is some positive sense to assist individuals and recipients of public assistance. I'd like us to try to make sure that we're providing the assistance where we're going to get the greatest gain. The General Relief Assistance Program, maybe not so much. This first section actually also, I don't want to belabor the subject. Currently under regulation, the General Relief Assistance Program already has language that requires citizenship. We do have one program that was mentioned earlier, the Senior Benefits Program, has no citizenship requirement currently. That was an oversight that's been going on for quite some time. So anything we can do to fix that hole would be greatly appreciated. Representative Seaton asked about precluded from eligibility under state or federal law. Again, those statutes just apply to the General Relief Assistance Program, but the sort of things that may preclude somebody from being eligible, especially for the General Relief Assistance Program, would be they don't truly have an emergent need. That's an emergent need program. Or they already receive benefits in the month for the same thing they're asking for. Again, they applied on the 1st, got rental assistance, and now they came in on the 15th and asked for rental assistance. Again, it's a one-shot deal. So it depends on the program. There are different federal rules and state rules that might preclude somebody for receiving assistance. If you're a fleeing drug felon, you're not eligible for food stamps, for instance.
Representative Ramble, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. Okay, so basically, I just want to make sure I heard you right. You said there's general relief, in the general relief fund, you said there's already has some sort of citizenship requirement. Can you get us the specific language of that?
Through the chair, Representative Ramble, yes, that's in regulation.
Okay, can you get that for us? And second, you're talking through the chair in regards to general relief and the rental assistance. I would like to know how many cash assistance people there are in the state. It's broken out to general relief, rental assistance, and cash assistance in general.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, again, general relief assistance, not really a cash assistance program. It's a cash benefit not paid to the applicant.
I got that.
Okay.
We're talking about talking about all the other programs. You've kind of isolated out just a couple little ones. If there's 190,000 Alaskans, getting some sort of a public assistance, as you stated in my office, I would like to know, the other programs that are cash assistance.
Mm-hmm. Sure, we can do that.
Go ahead. Thank you.
I think that one of the part of the challenge, there's going to be some operational challenges, there always are, but in the section where we're talking about investigations of applicants and recipients, that language is intended to serve the purpose when in an investigation, that's the interview process where we investigate their eligibility. So from an investigation standpoint, it's intended to be looking at getting information about their income, what their rental costs are, and things of that nature. For some of our programs, like our adult public assistance program that serves the elderly, the blind, and disabled, and many of our other programs, we rarely get to see a client face-to-face, especially those that are in rural Alaska. Oftentimes, they're working through a fee agent. So the opportunity for us to actually observe or to have an opportunity to get a sense about that person's capacities is kind of constrained by distance to some extent. So having that opportunity is fairly limited for us.
Did I hear you correct? Did you say e-agent?
Representative Haynes, Mr. Chair, that's a fee agent.
Oh, a fee agent. Okay. 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 I thought you were talking like an electronic agent or something like that. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and can we follow up on that just for a second? So are some of the applications made online or by mail, or is it all in person with a fee agent or someone else in a we're talking rural context here?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, virtually any individual that wants public assistance can apply via mail, can mail in an application. We don't have online applications in the sense now where you can punch in all of your data and we'll get it into our system. We're moving in that direction. Virtually all of our programs do require an interview, but that interview does not have to be face-to-face.
So following up.
Yep, go ahead.
So many times there'll be, or I presume it's quite often from rural Alaska, there'll be a paper submission and then a phone interview. Is that what I'm... Is that the normal process that we're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Yes, the fee agent system that we have in place. We have roughly 300 people in a little over 200 communities who serve as an agent of the state. They're not employees. They receive a fee for processing an application. They assist individuals to fill out the application, ask some very basic questions, and then they send that into our eligibility staff. If the eligibility staff has follow-up questions that need to be answered or there's missing information, they will make an attempt to make a phone contact with that individual and conduct an interview at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pardon me. Who are the individuals that serve as these fee agents?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, fee agents are served by eligibility staff in our regions. We have four regions in the state, and in some regions, like our coastal region, different offices oversee the fee agents to the extent that they're their go-to person or they send them information. So we have what we call fee agent coordinators in each one of our regions that work with those fee agents, make sure they're trained up, make sure they have the forms and understand how to complete them.
Cool. But just what kind of individual might serve in that capacity? Could I be a fee agent? Should I want to be by applying through the department? Just understanding a little bit more who those people are.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, pretty much it's individuals of interest that are interested in providing a community service. Oftentimes we will work with the local village council or the IRA, or in some parts of the state we may be working with a regional nonprofit as the foundation for the fee agent. For instance, here in Southeast, Metlakatla Indian Community supports the fee agents in their community, supports in the sense that they are actually employees of MIC, mm-hmm. Metlakatla Indian Community, as opposed to us.
Okay.
So generally, the bulk of the language that then follows in the subsequent sections that start with 4725, 450. Here we are talking about our adult public assistance recipients, the elderly, the blind, and disabled. And that includes disabled and visually impaired individuals of all ages. Again, oftentimes the individual that is the recipient may not be, they may be represented by someone else, a parent, a guardian ad litem, or some other individual that actually assists them in making the application, perhaps because of either their age or the disability they have. So oftentimes, again, we're not in direct contact with that individual necessarily. We may be working through a third party that's applying for that assistance. That again, and really what I'm driving to here is that the opportunity to base a reasonable suspicion of drug and alcohol abuse is going to be challenging for us in many situations. The place where we have the greatest latitude and the greatest flexibility is with the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program. And that's the one that provides cash assistance to families with dependent children. That program has work requirements, it's time limited. For assistance, and we've got the infrastructure necessary to provide the supports for those individuals and families. They have case managers that work their cases. We have a range of supports that are funded through the TANF block grant to provide supports for those individuals. Our adult public assistance program, 100% general fund, doesn't really have that sort of infrastructure necessary to support screening individuals, drug testing when necessary, things of that. So there will likely be some costs associated with pulling these other programs in that would be more than just the temporary assistance program.
Representative Keller?
Yeah, thank you. Could you give us some kind of an idea of what we're, I mean, in that arena, the cash assistance as opposed to through for services or contractors or whatever? I mean, can you give us some kind of breakdown? Like you did with the general assistance area?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, we have, and this is going to be very ballparky, about roughly 17,000 adult public assistance cases, elderly, blind, and disabled. It may be pushing closer to 18,000. I mean, typically it's one case equals one adult. And I can get you the breakdown on how many of those are blind, disabled, or elderly. I think that the disabled population is probably the largest segment of that caseload or that program's
Follow-up. No, my question was the cash assistance. That go, do they go to these seven, do the checks get written to those 17,000 people?
Chair, Representative Keller, yes, they do. They may be, in some instances, they may be sent to a protective payee or to an authorized representative.
Right.
That serves those folks. And for the temporary assistance program, we have about over 3,000. And about 25% of those are cases where you have a non-needy relative caring for the children.
Just out of curiosity, how much money are we talking? Do you know off the top of your head, ballpark figure monthly that we're doing this with?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be remiss if I tried to throw out numbers there.
Okay.
But it's significant investment.
Is it? Okay. I think, is there a way we could get that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
That would be grateful.
Normally, I would have brought it with me.
Okay. Representative Rebel?
And thank you. I'm virtually asking the same question. Out of the 190,000 people, roughly, that are on public assistance, I want the number of people that receive cash or checks, you know, whether it's a third party or anything like that, that number. Do you have a guesstimate of the total? I know you're excellent with numbers. You're one
of
the best.
Yeah, some days I'm good. Bearing in mind that, you know, close to 60,000 of those individuals are Medicaid recipients, I'll get you the real numbers rather than trying to impress you with my memory.
Even a guess?
Through the chair, pardon me, I think cases, 3,500 temporary assistance cases, two per household, I'd rather not guess. I'd rather get you the real numbers. And that can be done very quickly.
Right, and we would appreciate that, and we can give it out to the committee. I think Representative Keller, you had a question, right?
Yeah, another question I have is, assuming we just have what you're going to be asking if this bill were to pass would be for the applicants to sign a paper regarding alcohol abuse and substance abuse. Just your sense of it, do you think that would identify a large number? My initial response would be that it probably is a very insignificant number we're talking to compared to, for example, what I would suspect anyway for the temporary assistance, because of the category of people we're talking about, you know, the disabled net. But so what would you think would be the number of people that would be involved? And frankly, I kind of wonder if we wouldn't have some kind of a problem if we just applied it to one arena or two and not all three. I wonder then if we aren't getting back into the constitutional problems. You don't have to respond to that when we can let legal services do it. But that's a thought that's going through my mind. But my real question is, just from your experience, I mean, would you expect any problem from the adult assistance program finding people that there was evidence that maybe there's a problem?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that would require a lot of speculation. And to some extent, the fine line between occasional use and abuse, very difficult to ascertain. Alcohol abuse, it's so difficult to test for that, even in the best of times. So you could have somebody coming in representing as being intoxicated, but by the time you can get them to take a UA, nothing's going to show. So the basis, part of the challenge that we had with the predecessor to this committee substitute was how we confirmed or how we narrowed down that we actually had a suspicion-based referral process. To some extent, this is even a little more vague because it's a little more difficult to measure the truth of a statement at any one point in time. Perhaps they weren't using drugs when they signed it. So I think that there's some possible conflicts there. How do we really, what's the basis of the truthiness of their statement at that point in time? But as far as a number, it's no greater than the number of average Alaskans that are alcohol and substance abusers, I don't believe.
Representative Nogiak?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier, the number 190,000 had been bannered about, and earlier you said that 90% of the assistance of the 190,000, I think, 90% is burial assistance, general relief assistance, and dental assistance, or it was that, and then it's about 171,000, approximately, I think, that you're talking about, and what is the rest of that rest of that money going to for? Because you said most of it was burial assistance and dental assistance. So, what is the rest of that? The rest of the people.
Representative, through the chair, Representative Nogiak. I was speaking specifically about the General Relief Assistance Program, and on average, we've got about 1,000 people go through that program.
Oh, okay.
And of that, 40% of those are individuals who are very low income, who get burial assistance.
Oh, okay.
And the cost it amounts to 90% of the General Relief Assistance Program.
Okay, I got it wrong. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Did you have a question? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I make sure I'm following you. Because when we went through the sectional, the way we were referring to the different types of assistance, one, general relief, second section, the section 5 is adult assistance, and then section 9 is temporary assistance. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about, you know, adult assistance, you were calling that program adult assistance, I believe.
Through
right?
the chair, Representative Tarr, adult public assistance.
Adult public
yes.
assistance. And then when we talk about TANF, that's our temporary assistance.
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative
okay, Tarr.
That's
you.
The Alaska okay. Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program.
Yeah. Okay.
Gosh, you know, I really don't have anything to add. I think that there are some, you know, the issue was brought up about under the temporary assistance thing, where on page 6, line 4. We're talking about family members here. One of the other things that this piece of legislation doesn't do that was in the prior version of this, it makes it clear about 25% of the people that receive, who are applicants for or receive Alaska Temporary Assistance Program benefits, this is the classic welfare for moms and little kids, are what are referred to as non-needy relatives. So those are individuals who are caring for a child that they're typically related to, but don't have a need of their own. So they're receiving benefits just for that child. So it's your grandmother or someone's grandmother or an aunt or uncle taking care of their children. Under this legislation, those individuals who aren't receiving any cash assistance would probably be subject to that investigatory process, if you will. The prior legislation made it clear that when they were talking about recipients, we weren't talking about children, because in theory, everybody in the household that receives a benefit is a recipient. And if we're going to say that applicants and recipients are screened or investigated or whatnot, we would be talking about everybody unless the statute was clear that said in this instance a recipient is the adult that made application or something along those lines. Otherwise, you know, we would have that problem with having to look at the larger family as part of the review and investigation.
Representative Ramble, good question.
Oh, can you validate the number of total recipients on public assistance in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, if you mean everybody that's receiving a benefit from the state of Alaska's Division of Public Assistance,
correct.
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, yeah. If I'm recalling right, it was 190,000 in my office about 3 weeks
194.
ago. 194. Okay, thank you.
It might be up to 197 now.
Does the number, I know it probably goes up or down seasonally, right?
That's correct, Chairman.
Okay. You said why did it go up by 3,000? I mean, you said it could be up to 197 now. Just out of curiosity.
Mr. Chairman, I just, our caseloads ebb and flow. Okay. This is one of those periods of time where we might see a little bit of an increase. I believe the number Representative Reinbold was quoting was from our budget documents from last year, so that might have been our 2011 number was 194. But it's somewhere in that range. We'll get the exact numbers to you.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know, based on, you know, our population numbers, that we're 15% or so of Alaskans are receiving some sort of public assistance, is that comparable to other states? I just don't have any information on that, do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, no, I don't either. I don't have any information regarding that. I'm sure it's out there someplace.
Look for it. Thank you.
Any further questions?
No. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it. Hold on. Yep. Representative Seaton.
One of the questions that kind of came up was this assign a protective payee to manage the cash assistance. Can you kind of give me a flavor for what that would be? And I was kind of concerned of how that translates into family interactions or whether that almost requires a finding of neglect on the applicant. I want to get a handle on whether we have unintended consequences that could arise from the designations we're making in here.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. Technically, a protective payee is an individual who is assigned to manage somebody else's finances because they're not competent to do it. It's most common in our adult public assistance program, and typically we piggyback on the Social Security Administration's models for that. There's individuals out there that basically have businesses where they manage other individuals' welfare recipients' funds. We also use something that we refer to as authorized representatives, and that's an individual who is selected by the family or household to represent them. They can report changes on behalf of the household, go to the interviews with the household or on behalf of the household, and may even be copied with their benefit or have access to their benefits.
Follow. And I guess, seeing here on page 5 where it's added under section 11, it seems to be added there in conjunction with a finding that somebody provided false information or misrepresents. I presume that this is in conjunction with alcohol abuse, you know, knowing that it was false to the department to obtain benefits. And I'm trying to figure out if that was a departmental determination that someone had abused alcohol and hadn't, in the sworn statement, had actually said that they weren't going to. Is that what, as this bill is written, I'm trying to figure out exactly how it goes. Does that mean that the department might assign a protective payee? And what would that mean consequentially for the individual who is the applicant, who is now the department, has determined that they are not competent, basically? Or, I mean, is there a waterfall event here that's occurring that's not strictly what was intended, but that could have big consequences legally? And I know you're not the lawyer, but I'm trying to figure out within the Department of Social Services, does this have a waterfall consequence the way this is interpreted?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, a difficult question to answer. This section is actually inserted into the section, I believe, if I'm correct, governing penalties for noncompliance with activities that are assigned to an individual as far as their family self-sufficiency plan goes. So this penalty provision in here may be maybe this might not be the right section for this to be in, because this is talking about penalty progression. You didn't do an activity that I assigned you toward your self-sufficiency. You didn't go to job search. So I'm going to, because you didn't do that, you're not compliant, and you just told me you're not going to be compliant, I'm going to reduce your benefit by 40%. And then 3 months later, I'm going to chop it again. This is kind of throwing a different piece in it, basically saying that we can basically cut you off entirely at this point in time. The waterfall effect, I guess if there isn't any here, is I think that Representative Nagyak spoke to that, is what are the implications of denying or terminating benefits for an individual who has dependent children? Presumably, at this point in time, they wouldn't be able to, if we denied their benefits, they wouldn't be able to pay rent, things of that nature. We'd probably be looking at a referral to Office of Children's Services, and who knows what the downstream effect would be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on that point, because earlier, I think, in the presentation, it was said that this legislation isn't intended to lead to criminal investigations, but because of other existing statute, could it be interpreted that once you identified substance abuse in a home, then the children were at risk and it would legally have to be reported?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that could be a consequence.
Representative Rambo.
Thank you. In regards to this cash that we're giving out, that you're going to get us the total number, because you know, with that general relief, it was only 1,000 people, so we still have the 189,000 people we're dealing with, or 194,000 or 197,000. Anyway, close. Basically, this cash that's written, can it potentially be used for other things? It doesn't necessarily have to go. I mean, they can be using it for let's say, alcohol, if they're given cash.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, there at this point in time, there isn't any condition on that. Many of our adult public assistance recipients receive their benefits through direct deposit. Our temporary assistance recipients receive their benefits on the Quest card. So, yeah, there would be nothing to prevent them from buying a TV, tobacco, a jug of wine.
Thank you.
Representative Keller, you wanted to close.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you to Ron. We and the department, they were right there with the original copy of the bill, and we, you know, told us some of their problems with it, and they've been there and available to help out as we go. And I think that is still our attitude, just speaking for them. He can say that if he wants to. But I do want to say that I'm determined. I do believe that we don't want to be enabling addiction, you know, in the process of trying to help, you know. And so it seems to me like there has to be something there to be able to determine whether or not the problem exists. And I'm looking for that way, and I also am looking for your help to help me get there. So thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, thank you very much for that. And if I could, I would encourage us to focus on the programs and services that we have, the resources and the span of control over to get this moving forward. And the temporary assistance program is an ideal situation for that, because we do have case managers that are assigned to work with families. We've got a support system in place. At this point in time, we are testing the Alaska screening tool there. I think for many of our other recipients, the level of contact we have with them is insufficient for us to really get the kind of gains that we want to have. And by testing it against the Alaska Temporary Assistance population, we'll be able to refine it and figure out how we can move this service and this interest into these other programs where there's some suspicion, you know, concern that there may be substance abuse and alcohol abuse occurring too.
Do you have a question, Representative Nagyak?
I have. A statement, if I may. Before.
Well, we're running out of time here, but.
I mean, you know, okay, just a small one. thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm, what, you know, we're talking about all these social and network programs and everything. I think I said earlier, and I still continue to say that we need access to our resources, and we have, and you know, we need to fix some of the problems in our natural resource issues in order to you know, for people to get back and helping themselves find a job with renewable resources, non-renewable resources, and all that. But it takes access to our resources in order to do that. So if we want to get rid of some of these programs that people have a big headache about, I think what we need to do is to provide those jobs, and especially in rural Alaska, to help people help themselves. And that way, they can have high esteem, you know, back, you know, become to help support their families. I think that's what we should concentrate on, and to get our resources that are abundant in our state that, you know, that we have barely tapped. If we could do that, we'd have a lot more jobs, and some of these issues, I think, would become less if people are happy and with jobs. Thank you.
Thank you for your time, and for sitting up there and taking our questions, and I'm sure we'll have you back.
Thank you.
Now, at this time, we're going to open this bill up to public testimony. We'll limit testimony to 3 minutes per person, and I believe we have some people online. Joy Huntington, are you there, Joy?
Yes, I am, Chairman. Thank you for it. Do you want me to get started?
Yeah, put your name and your affiliation on the record, if you don't mind.
Oh, definitely. My name is Joy Huntington, and I have the pleasure of representing the communities of the Tanana Chiefs Conference region and our nonprofit Native organization in the interior. Thank you so much. I've met several of you down in Juneau, and for those of you that I haven't met, I look forward to the privilege of sitting in your offices and getting to know you a little better. I'm calling to, you know, just recently, actually, on February 26th, TCC co-sponsored a lunch and learn there in Juneau, and it was regarding our TANF programs. We partnered with Cook Inlet Tribal Council in Anchorage and Tlingit and Haida Central Council in Juneau. So I went to, you know, to some of the offices, and went to Representative Keller's office to make sure he was invited to come down. Really, our purpose is to get good information out there. I couldn't agree more with Representative Tarr that it is unwise, as she put it, to give money to fund addiction and to fund all of these social ails that, you know, honestly, you know, are devastating. And I can personally, you know, testify to that, that, you know, my own, in my own experience, you know, alcohol and drug abuse has been devastating. And I just wanted to really emphasize that, you know, and I haven't heard Alaska Native brought up many times during this hearing, but really that if you counted the amount of times that Alaska Native, you know, is used in the bill, if there's an emphasis there. And I don't know, you know, to the degree, it sounds like it's, you know, one of the programs that's being talked about, but really I just wanted to, you know, say that it's, you know, this is definitely an emphasis in the bill, and we want to bring that forward. And TCC is really dedicated. We operate the TANF program, and there's a focus on flexibility in the program currently, and that was basically, you know, through statute, through the funding from the federal government when this program was created for the temporary assistance for needy families, and particularly the tribal component of that, which is the funding that the state gets, which actually then funnels it to some of our nonprofit organizations. But really, the flexibility is key, and we have implemented drug testing from day one, which I haven't heard mentioned. The current policies in place for drug testing, helping families that have a problem get through treatment. So really, I just want to emphasize that there are current policies in place that emphasize drug abuse, and really we feel that that's so important. I can't go get a checkup at our clinic here in Fairbanks without anybody asking me about, you know, how much I use alcohol and drugs. You know, it's just a very regular part of helping people in our communities. And so I just want to say that TCC is committed to that as much as you are. And in fact, for 14 years, we've been drug testing people and really focusing on their overall and the success of the families on these programs. We work closely with Commissioner Struer to make sure that these programs do what they're supposed to, and we have had extreme success going from 400 families to 200. So that means people are getting jobs, we're giving them job trainings, we're doing parenting classes, and all of that is made possible through the flexibility of this funding. And so we don't want that part to go away, because we get to be creative and say, our parents need parenting classes, people need job training, let's find a way to make them successful. And addressing alcohol and drug abuse is just one component of that. And as Representative Nagyak has emphasized, that there's a big picture here. And I can't say how much that is really true. So giving people parenting classes and giving them tools that they need to be successful is really the big picture, the big approach. And, you know, honestly, I can't agree more that this is important. I would like to see, you know, the funding issue be addressed as well. And so to end, I know I'm limited on time here, but TCC recommends that support is given to employment and training programs, alcohol and substance abuse treatment and prevention services, and local economic development efforts. While these assistance programs are ongoing, I would really urge you to look at what drug testing exists already. So if it's not broken, we don't need to fix it, in my opinion, especially with our tribal TANF programs. And as I've heard recently, $8.5 million is being cut from the behavioral health budget. So if we're really taking this issue seriously, which I agree the state needs to do, how are we doing that? And if we're cutting behavioral health, which is really aimed at helping people deal with these devastating issues that I've seen people struggle with and fight against in their own lives, and some succeed and some, unfortunately, you know, don't succeed. So I would like us to stay big picture. I appreciate your time and the work that each of you do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving us the opportunity to speak here. And if anybody has any questions about our program specifically, please give me a call over at TCC or my cell phone number, which I'm sure one of the staff members in Chairman Higgins' offices has. So thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to take questions if you have any, or future questions as well.
Well, Joy, we do have a question for you. Representative Ramble?
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. It was really good, and I'm glad that you guys are already on the ball and doing drug testing and things like that. However, you said it was in policy. Policies can change, and I think having this in statute is much more powerful. And to me, if you're already doing this, it's just going to empower you more and reinforce what you're doing. So I would assume that you would be supporting this bill.
And the difference is, ma'am, Representative, I appreciate that question. The difference is that currently we go through our process that really it's not a cookie cutter approach. It's based on what's working best with the people that we're working with. So how that drug testing is applied, and so there's freedom there, I guess, to really meet people in a way that works best, whether that's you know, the questioning, surveys, those kinds of efforts. So I think that, you know, in some ways I understand your question, and that yes, we do support drug testing, and we also don't want this cookie cutter approach that might not work for everybody. And really it's going to cost money, because drug tests definitely do have a tangible cost to them, which I hope is not going to fall on the shoulders of the Native entities that are operating this program. So I hear where you're coming from, but I feel like, you know, if you look at the purpose on the federal website, it talks about granting, provides assistance and work opportunities to needy families by granting states the federal funds and wide flexibility to develop and implement their own welfare programs. And so I feel like that is also when the state gives money to the tribal entities, respecting, you know, that wide flexibility. And I feel like, especially when it comes to the Native entities, we emphasize, like, the overall success and well-being of the family. And so there will never be a time when addressing alcohol abuse and drug abuse is not a part of that picture. So, yes, policies change, but I think they're there, you know, for a reason. And, you know, I know the state does have an interest here, but yes, I think I answered the question. Thank you.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up, please. Yes, and you know, I appreciate that. I'm going to support this bill. I'm a big believer in it because we do have a serious problem with abuse in the state. We have serious abuse with alcohol. We have serious drug abuse. And I think that screening them, identifying them, and getting them into treatment, education, and prevention is the key. So I think this is an awesome tool to identify the problem.
Thank you. Thank you, Joy, for talking with us. And we'll probably be hearing from you again.
Sounds great. Right. Thank you all.
You're welcome. Jeffrey, are you online?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska. We previously provided written testimony to the committee with respect to the prior bill. With respect to the committee substitute, I appreciate the lengthy discussion the committee engaged in. Very briefly, the ACLU continues to oppose this bill and the CS. While it's beginning to move in the right direction, there are problems. Generally, as to the constitutionality, while there is no requirement that a state provide certain benefits of any kind to individuals or that there be programs, there may not be a constitutional requirement for a program to exist. However, once the state establishes a program, it must do so in a way that meets constitutional requirements, and that's both Alaska state constitutional requirements and U.S. federal constitutional requirements. Essentially, what the case law has said, and we will, of course, provide written testimony so that the members of the committee can review our citations at their leisure. What the case has said is that a forced search is not constitutional. As we read the language, and again, this is a relatively new CS, so we want to do more detailed study and provide a citation. The way it is written, although it is fashioned as a suspicion-based testing scheme, unfortunately, the devil, as we say, is in the details. The scheme, as it is currently set forth in the CS, does not meet constitutional requirements, and that's essentially a coerced search. That's, at the 35,000-foot level, the largest problem. At this point, rather than go on and prior to the written testimony, I'm happy to take any questions there may be.
Well, Jeffrey, I have a question. So then, if we wanted to move forward with this bill, then, and we want to make it constitutional, then we could hope that you would help us with that document so that we get it right, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. The ACLU is always happy to work with legislators, and we have in the past, and will continue to do so. There are schemes in other states. There are programs for testing that, although the ACLU may not believe that they're the best policy, have been found constitutional by courts. And we can certainly provide guidance as to those schemes where courts have reviewed them and determined that they do meet the requirements of avoiding any violations of Bill of Rights clauses.
Thank you. Were there any questions? No. Thank you for your time, and your, especially both of you, for your patience for waiting so long. But we'll probably be hearing from you again. Thank you. Is there anybody on the floor here that would like to testify? Well, with that said, this bill will be back before us, so I'm going to leave public testimony open at this time. And so with that, our next HES committee meeting will be at 3 p.m. on March the 14th. It'll be an interesting one, as they all are. We'll begin our next meeting with confirmation hearing for the State Medical Board, which will be followed by a presentation on the Affordable Care Act. So with that, we will gavel out, and the time is 4:45.